Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comments. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter. And that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bed, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current event. Greetings and salutations, everyone. Greetings and salutations. I am very excited to have Mr. Healthcare, Anton Gunn, joining us today. Now, Mr. Gunn is a nationally acclaimed leader, expert, consultant, and speaker on healthcare reform. He is the founder and president of the 937 Strategy Group, a consulting firm based in Washington, D.C. Now, previously, he served as a senior official in the Obama administration and as the Director of External Affairs at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, where he advised President Obama and Secretary Kathleen Abetz. That interview will be leading our 5 o'clock hour, so I'm very excited to have him joining us today. But before we do that, there's a few issues in the current events that we want to discuss. Primarily, the issue, this is blog post that was posted out, and I want to ask the question, is college football the new plantation? It's an interesting blog post we'll talk about. Also, Reverend Jesse Jackson, 30 years after his Syria liberation, we'll talk a little bit about that and much, much more. But before I do that, I want to send a shout out. I don't know if that's the appropriate word or not, but let me start by saying Happy Founders Day to my brothers at Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity Incorporated. And of course, a special shout out to Beta Theta, Omicron Zeta, Omicron Pi, Eta Chi, Gamma Phi Newts, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention my sons, my brother, Marcus Barnett, my deuces, and to the hard way. He's in chapter Invisible. May the Lord really bless his soul and his family. But happy Founders Day to the brothers at Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity and Kappa, Incorporated.
Hand me down my Kappa cane. I said, hand me down my Kappa cane. I said, hand me down my Kappa cane. I'm gonna take a stroll one day down Kappa Lane.
Tell 'em about it. Yeah, again, happy Founders Day to Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity Incorporated. And now, the current events. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number to call is 323-580-5712. The phone lines are open, and joining me is the executive producer of Current Events and, of course, the chief operating officer of Cook Enterprises. Now, you can follow her on Twitter, and that's at A-S-K-J-E-M-A, A-S-K-J-E-M-A, as Jima. And so, without further ado, Jima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about this article, but I want to first say about, now, you know, Reverend Jesse Jackson has said on many occasions, March Madness leads to May Sadness, where he was primarily addressing the number of basketball athletes that were playing the game. Now, in fact, there's an article in the St. Louis American written by Jesse Jackson several years ago, and it reads, March Madness, we witness young athletes in brilliant motion doing the impossible under intense pressure, nail-biting overtime games, stirring comebacks, agonizing defeats. Network television broadcasts the show to millions across the world, with the high-gloss ad celebrating the great colleges involved. Now, too often, March Madness is followed by May Sadness. The players that star in March are often not there in May at graduation time. The proud mothers in the stands aren't present in the graduation ceremony. The celebrated colleges too often are failing their promise to provide a college education to young athletes. Well, there's a blog post out that's recently attributed to DeMario Solomon Simmons entitled Bowled Over, BCS Schools Failing Their Black Male Athletes, which addresses a similar issue with college football. Now, of course, the context of Reverend Jackson's comments were in the comments of college basketball, the context of college basketball. This new article is in the context of college football. Now, the blog cites an extraordinary set of statistics that was out of the University of Pennsylvania Center for the Study of Race Inequality. Jima, do you remember the conversation that Reverend Jackson has several years ago about March Madness and May Sadness?
I don't remember it specifically. I just know that every year he brings to our attention that we are not graduating as many students that we have that are seen all the time on the court, on the field, or whatever. And that there has to be some accountability from the university's perspective on making sure that we are not only educating them, but that we, that they're not only keeping them eligible where they can play for them, but that they're getting the education while they're there. And I know the other side of that is going to be where the kid has a responsibility, which is true. We're not taking any responsibility away from the student athlete, but he is a student or she is a student athlete, a student first. There should be. So there still has to be some responsibility on the institution to ensure that not only is the student eligible to play, but that the student is learning what it needs to learn while they're there.
That makes sense. And so let's dissect for a moment the article attributed to DeMario Solomon Simmons that he wrote several days ago. Now, in the article he writes, the explosive growth of black athletes participating in big-time college football will be on full display during the upcoming Bowl Championship Series, the BCS. Today, almost 60% of all college players, football players that is, are black. And it would be hard to find any top team where black players make up less than 80% of their starters. Unfortunately, far too many of these black male athletes' athletic progress has not translated into academic success. This sad scenario is the subject of a new report titled Black Male Student Athletes and the 2014 Bowl Champion Series from the University of Pennsylvania Center for the Study of Race and Equality. The report published under the visionary leadership of Dr. Sean Harper found startling and significant graduation rate disparities between black male athletes and the number of other student groups at the top 25 BCS schools. For example, black males comprise only 3% of the overall undergraduate student population, but 60% of the football players. Black male football players' graduation rates are 23% less than the overall undergraduate student population and 17 percentage points lower than the overall student-athlete population. Among the 10 colleges competing in this year's BCS Bowl Games, only Stanford has a graduation rate of black male athletes over 53%. At the University of Oklahoma, the rate is just 42%. Add in the fact that the NCAA-controlled College Sports Entertainment Complex, which features guaranteed multi-million-dollar-a-year contract for coaches and allows conferences to bathe in multi-billion-dollar TV deals and universities to enter into profitable licensing and merchandising contracts, is made possible mostly by the uncompensated labor of poor intercity black males. Clearly, the NCAA and its members' institutions are benefiting greatly at the expense of black male athletes. This is why some refer to big-time college sports as the new plantation, likening black male athletes' experiences to the exploitation endured by internally colonized people in the system of slavery. So, Jima, my question that I posed earlier, is college sports, in particular football and basketball, the new plantation for black athletes?
Well, when you just think of it in its most general term, they are working for free. The university gets paid, as was outlined in your introduction there, from the BCS. We can just talk about that since that's the most recent. Most of those schools that were in the BCS Bowl, each school got $18 million. $18 million. So let's say you have three or four, you know, maybe two or three teams out of your conference going to a bowl game, you know, do the math on that. $36 million will go to the SEC or to the Big 12. And that's just from that part. We're not even talking about what the coaches, how much the coaches make and their endorsements, what the school makes off of the kids' jerseys and their likeness on games and all that. So everybody around the student-athlete is getting paid except for the student-athlete. And so there has to be somewhere in the middle. You know, I know they get an education. I get that. But then if the goal is to educate them, then the goal should be to graduate them. So however long it takes for them to get that degree, they ought to be able to stay in school until they get it, especially, you know, a top-tier athlete. I mean, and even it doesn't matter whether they're top-tier or not. It doesn't matter. I think every athlete that puts on that uniform and goes out there and gives his best and gives up his life, really, for 4 years or five, because, you know, their break or summer, they're doing two-a-days in football, and that's early in June. Oklahoma, Texas is hot. So, you know, you're dealing with the heat down south in Alabama, Georgia. You're dealing with the heat in those two-a-days. And so they put their bodies through so much and are expected to do so much on that field come Saturday or come Thursday or Friday or whatever day they're playing on. And yet, you know, they're not compensated for what they do. So there has to be somewhere in the middle. You know, if you don't want to pay them for their services, then you need to guarantee that they have a degree when they leave that institution. And by guarantee, it doesn't mean they get it in the four, because chances are they may not get it in the four because they've spent the majority of their time being more focused on football and less on their studies or basketball or track or baseball or whatever. And so ensure, you know, give them an extra 2 years, pay, you know, do something where that student can go back home with something more than what he left with. Because he left with a dream, and we know the numbers of athletes that make it on the pro level is low, you know, and everybody thinks they're good enough to go to the pros. Everybody does. No, you know, most kids that start out in Pop Warner and Pee Wee leagues and parents pushing them, and then you go to basketball and then you AAU leagues, and they're traveling all around the country. Well, they're traveling all around the country because they think their child is the next one. And the coaches think that, you know, that's where a lot of energy is put. And so then at the end of the day, they go to college, and let's say they are the next one, but then they get hurt. What's the fallback there? You know, so I really think that the colleges have some sort of responsibility to ensure that when that student leaves, that they at least have a degree. That's I mean, if you're not going to pay them a stipend, which they do get stipends, but if you're not going to pay them with the amount that they make for you in university, then you should at least make sure that they have a degree when they leave.
Okay. I mean, I think I'm going to challenge that notion here shortly. But I want to go ahead and continue to unpack DeMario Solomon Simmons' article a little bit more. He also wrote in the article that he said, of course, black male athletes are not enslaved and even have the choice not to play college sports. Furthermore, black male athletes have a personal responsibility to maximize the educational and life skill opportunities available when attending elite universities. Yes, as one expert has said, it is known that young blacks are encouraged toward attempts at making it through athletic participation rather than pursuit of education. In other words, this dangerous belief in the sports lottery leads many black males to single-mindedly pursue sports to the exclusion of academic interests because it is perceived as the only way to get mama out of the hood. I, too, had aspiration, the article reads, of playing in the NFL to help black male student athletes coming from disadvantaged schools and neighborhoods adjust and thrive in college settings. The NCAA and its member institutions should utilize some of the billions in new TV revenue to adopt and pay for specific policies and programs that would provide much-needed resources and support. These should include, now he goes on to give some specific antidotes here. These should include the academic personnel have extensive training to work and understand the cultures of the different types of black males. East Coast, Dirty South, Southern Cal, etc., who come from unique non-white social cultural backgrounds and therefore have special needs that must be met in order to become successful college students and men. He also says that creating and supporting a senior black male administrator position on each campus to ensure the existence of positive role models for black male athletes in the same manner that each campus has a senior woman administrator. This is news to me. Financially supporting the creation of the National Black Student Athlete Association to create a critical mass of high-achieving black male athletes through peer-to-peer networking and opportunities for leadership and professional development for black student athletes. And then finally, he says, financially supporting a bridge builder mentoring program on each campus as a mandatory program that begins immediately after a black male athlete signs his scholarship agreement and continues through education. Now, he says that by implementing these policies and programs and others like them, the NCAA and university can create a social cultural environment that will produce the trust, confidence, and motivation of black athletes that is needed to inform, inspire, and empower them toward academic and life success. Doing so will yield high dividends for the NCAA, its member institution, black male athletes, and indeed our nation. So, Jima, nowhere in this particular antidote did he outline, or this solution suggestion that he outlined, any kind of compensation. What do you make of that?
Well, I still think he brought up some good points, though. I mean, you know, because, and he may know more than I, having been a former athlete himself, that the probability of them paying them is probably not going to happen, which we have the discussion every year around bowl championship time, every year around March Madness time. The conversation goes to, you know, paying the athletes and making sure the athletes, you know, are graduating as well. But I think the things that he's talking about are not as divisive as paying the athletes. I don't think it's divisive. I think it's smart business. And if you did it for one group, and that group being for women, and what you saw was important for women to have on campus, then if you notice that there is a certain issue happening with black male students when they come on campus, black male athletes for sure, then instituting some of those things you talked about, I think would really fare well for everybody. It's a win-win for everybody, you know. And so although he didn't mention, you know, paying of the athletes or whatever, I think the solutions that he brought forth, I think are if we could do it, if they could test it out at a couple of schools in each conference and see if it had any impact. You know, what's the data now? What are we trying to measure when we do put those things into place? And then, you know, what comes after that? You know, after we've had a couple of test sites, because you got to test things out. You don't go in and throw, make everybody do it, because it might not be an issue on that campus. So, you know, you have to identify what the issues are on those major college campuses, and then begin to put things in place to address, you know, what some of those systemic issues are. Because a lot of them are just that, and they're ingrained in the system. And so there has to be a voice that says, just because we've done it this way all these years, the whole 100 years of the institution, doesn't mean we can't now make some adjustments to that, you know. And so I think some of the things that he brought out are very good suggestions, and I hope somebody's listening to them, especially there in the state of Oklahoma.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to trying to shift the conversation a little bit. Same topic, but I want to ask a little bit more pointed questions at this particular issue, especially around exploitation, right? Because that's the topic. You know, people are saying the NCAA or the college sports are exploiting these athletes. So what's wrong with that? What's wrong with the NCAA exploiting? Okay, maybe I should use a less harsh word. What's wrong with the NCAA leveraging the students' unique physical abilities for financial prosperity, let's say? Because, after all, corporations do it.
Because you're dealing with students, people who come from some very impoverished backgrounds, and as the article that he put out stated, that their whole goal is to be able to be the next one to go and take care of mama and build mama a house. And if I get hurt on your campus, you don't have to do anything for me. You're not obligated to me at all to pay for anything. You're not obligated for me to stay there and finish my degree. And so that doesn't seem fair. I'm not trying to be Pollyannish about it, but it just seems as though with all the money, and as the years go on, it gets to be more and more money. 20 years ago, we would have never thought that an institution would be making $18 million off of a football game. Who would have thought that? A college football game at that. Who would have thought that? You know, and so times are changing. And so what might have been okay in the past, because of the dollar signs that are now attached to these bowl games and all the sponsorships. I mean, we were watching bowl games. One was Fight Hunger or Feed the Hunger or something. And I'm like, well, who's benefiting from that bowl game? Are they taking the proceeds from that and going out and feeding the hungry? Or is it just a way for that school to make some money? I mean, what does the school do with the money they got from the Feed the Hunger Bowl? I mean, so, you know, there's just, it's all about sponsorship. And it's all about dollars, but it's how many athletic facilities does one college campus need? How many more seats do you need to put in your stadium? And yet your kids are coming in below, you know, reading or are barely at their grade level at reading, and they leave out barely at their grade level at reading. I mean, come on. And as an institution, you're okay with that? You're okay with your students,
yeah,
you know, that you
yeah,
have
yeah,
that
yeah.
you have on the field? I mean, you get them tutors to learn the game. Get them a tutor to pass their math class.
Yeah, but they're in the business of making money. They're not in the business of educating
kids. No. No, they were not. You mean to tell me that colleges were always in the business of making money? They were not in business to educate? Is that what you're telling me?
I'm saying that these colleges are in the business of making money. Otherwise, tuitions wouldn't be skyrocketing. Otherwise, you wouldn't have a billion-dollar institution for football and basketball. I mean, this is an enterprise. This is a capitalistic enterprise, making money.
But when did that happen? That's my question. When did that become the norm?
I think it's always been the case. I mean, it's certainly in the last couple of decades.
For sure. But before that, what were they doing? Before they became the TV rights and colleges getting their own networks like Texas Longhorn Network, seriously? I mean, before the SEC had its own network channels and stuff, what were these colleges doing? What were they doing? How were they? And it's been this way. They've never completely, as far as I know, and I'm not a college athlete, so if there's anybody out there listening, please call to correct me if I'm saying something that's not right. But I don't think they've ever fully taken care of the student athlete. I really don't. So this isn't anything new. It's just gotten progressively worse, and we see it so much more because of the amount of technology that we have. And we're able to see it because when we're watching these bowl games and we're watching these games on Saturdays playing at, because college game day doesn't just go to any old stadium. It's at the major stadium. You know, you think about that. You've never seen college game day just at any old rinky-dink school game. You got to be in the top, and your stadium has to be at the top. So what is that all about? You know, and how does that make the kids that didn't quite make it to a D1 school feel? You know, what does it say about your, you know, HBCU school? You know, they don't get all those endorsement deals, but they produce some fine athletes, though.
Yeah, but let me go back to something you said. And it's primarily associated with college athletes not getting something, because they used to get a lot. And primarily, I'm going to say pre-college football death penalty, players were getting paid out the yin-yang, all kind of ways. Now, quite naturally, the NCAA wanted to capitalize on some of those finances and kind of pull that rug from under the athlete. And so it's becoming a bigger issue now, because there's really an unwritten rule, and there's some written rules around compensating athletes, college athletes. So now the little money that was being filtered down to the college athletes is now being kind of sifted from them. And so now this is when I think it has starting to become a bigger issue, because there's nothing going to the college athletes now, or it's very little. And so that becomes a problem. I mean, before, everything was kind of under the rug, under the table, everything was cool, everything was okay. But now they're saying, nope, don't do it at all, period. And so now it's become a bigger issue. So my question really is around, you know, I asked the question about what's wrong with the NCAA exploiting, leveraging students' unique physical abilities. Well, and the fact that people are trying to associate this with slavery, I want to say, well, slavery was an involuntary thing. Going to college is a voluntary thing. Playing college sports is a voluntary thing. And if the system has been explained very thoroughly to these athletes, then it's really incumbent upon the athletes as well as the fans to stand up against this NCAA machine, as opposed to NCAA saying, nope, I'm going to give away billions of dollars. What do you think?
Well, here's the deal. This is why I said what the things that was placed in the article were not divisive. And that he offered solutions that can happen on any campus, right? Paying athletes, okay. Here's my own personal experience. I went to the University of Oklahoma back in the late '80s, and I was an out-of-state student. Yeah, late '80s. I was waiting for your comeback there. Late '80s, I was an out-of-state student paying out-of-state tuition. Now back then, I don't know if this still happens or not, but you know, college athletes were getting financial aid. Now, as an out-of-state student paying out-of-state tuition, I was highly offended that they were able to get financial aid, because what did they need financial aid for? They were there on scholarship. They had room and board. Everything was taken care of. Their books were paid for. So why were they getting financial aid? So you're here the other side of they already getting paid, because I was the one that said they was already getting paid. I felt like they were already getting paid through their education, as well as what you stated earlier about how things used to happen from the boosters and things of that nature. Okay, well, since that has stopped and all the money now is funneled through the university and all the money is going to the coaches and to the school, although they're still getting that education, they're making that school so much more money. And I just think I keep going back to the word fair, and that's probably not the best word in these circumstances, but I think it would be fair for them to compensate that athlete in some way outside of his degree or her degree. I just think, you know, even if they didn't pay them while they were there, if they had a fund set up for them so that when they left, they had something. Because like I stated, every kid is not going to the pros. So if your whole goal in college was to be the best so you can make it to the next level and you don't make it, then you end up at home, wow, that's such a letdown. But if you end up back home with a little bit of change in your pocket, the probability of you being a little bit more successful is higher. If you end up back home with a little change and a degree, you know, and a plan for what you plan to do now that you know you ain't going to make it to the pros, I mean, the probability for you being successful increases. And so, and where you're not a burden on society, where you're not, you know, someone that we have to, you know, clutch our pearls and hold our purses tight when we see walking down the street, because now you have a plan and you have a purpose. So there just has to be a better way. And I get it, it's big business. They're making all the money. They are providing the athlete with an education. I get that. I'm not going to take any of that away. However, comma, at the end of the day, they are making way more off of one athlete, whether he's a top or the last man coming off the bench. They making money off of everybody. And so at some point, I think that the athlete ought to get some sort of compensation for that. How they do it, that's the biggest unanswered question, and that's why we haven't, you know, gone any further than us talking about it every year, because nobody can figure out what to do. Nobody can figure out how to do it.
Yeah, because nobody won't lose any of their money, because there's a lot of being distributed. The question I have is, where is it all going? Because I'm not seeing any of it. And, you know, in these scholarships, it makes sense to pay millions and millions of dollars in scholarship to get the school built and to start out. But after years and years of it, I mean, that money has to be going in somebody's pocket. At any rate, time for a quick break. At the top of the hour, Anton Gunn, Mr. Healthcare, will be joining us. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Shima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my equal.
need a new website, haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full-service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. In just a few minutes here, we're going to be having Mr. Healthcare join us at the top of the hour. And so we're going to be discussing the Affordable Care Act. There's a lot of questions around the Affordable Care Act now that it's out. And we're going to be asking Mr. Gunn about those things. We want to make sure that you're well informed, that you're taking the best opportunities that are available to you for the Affordable Care Act. I think it's a wonderful thing, and I just want to make sure that we want to make sure that people are getting the right information and to make sure that there are some questions that can be answered out there to assist you in your endeavors out there. So, Jima, I want to talk a little bit now about Melissa Harris Perry and the fact that she did this, what some are reporting, this tearful apology. Let's take a listen and then let's talk about it a little bit.
My intention was not malicious, but I broke the ground rule that families are off limits, and for that I am sorry. Also, allow me to apologize to other families formed through transracial adoption, because I am deeply sorry that we suggested that interracial families are in any way funny or deserving of ridicule. On this program, we are dedicated to advocating for a wide diversity of families. It is one of our core principles, and I am reminded that when we are doing so, it must always be with the utmost respect. Genuinely appreciative of everyone who offered serious criticisms of last Sunday's program. And I am reminded that our fiercest critics can sometimes be our best teachers.
Okay. I mean, there was a lot of good rhetoric there. I think there was some definitely emotion, a lot of emotion there. But I am a little concerned at liberals or independents or whatever they want to call themselves, so quick to defend themselves when they exercise the same freedom of speech rights that the right wing exercise when they make idle threats at the president, or when they make suggestions about his birth certificate, or they make comments about any of those things. They're not asked in the same manner to apologize per se as if that we're seeing here on Melissa Harris Perry. Now, granted, Rush Limbaugh does this frequently, and he makes no effort to apologize, especially to that and to that magnitude. So do we have a double standard here, Gina?
Of course we have a double standard, and let's just be real clear about this. You had, you know, the President of the United States have to come on TV and apologize for a daggone website that wasn't working properly. The President of the United States, Bush ain't apologized for nothing, as far as I can recall. I don't remember Bush ever saying, I'm sorry, I lied. No, there wasn't any weapons of mass destruction. No, we were wrong. I don't ever recall him or anybody in his administration having to come on TV and apologize. But since this president has been in office, people of color, people who are more liberal, have had to apologize for more things than I can ever imagine. They can say, and it is divisive how they do it, and but Fox News can say whatever it wants to say about whomever it wants. Is driven by those in power, and those in power tend to be older white male, period. That's who's in power. That's who's in charge. And so if the narrative isn't in their favor, then that's not what they're going to talk about. if they feel like they've been offended by something, then we're going to talk about it. And then, you look at what happened with the NSA stuff. You know, the NSA's been spying on people of color forever. You know, you can go back to how they spied on Martin Luther King, Malcolm, and anybody in the civil rights movement. But now, all of a sudden, that you think they're listening in on your phone call, now we need to change the law. We need to change the process. So it is a double standard, and it's unfortunate that Melissa got caught up in it because I don't think she had any ill will at all. She was doing a year-end review of different, you know, stories that made headlines, you know, different pictures that made headlines or whatever. So I don't think she meant anything by it. I think her apology that she put out the next day should have been enough. But for her to have to still be groveling at this point, basically begging to keep her job, I think is unacceptable. I really do, because I don't see anybody over on Fox News ever having to grovel to keep their job and give them a tear-filled apology, which I felt it, you know, listening to it, and I commend her for it. Her own background is of mixed race, so I know she didn't have any malicious intent in that. So it should be a done deal. But it's the same thing they did with Martin Bashir. I mean, you know, he didn't say anything that probably nobody has thought about saying. Sarah Palin can get on TV and say whatever she wants to say. You just had a Fox News have somebody on their channel who calls for the assassination of us on TV and can talk, you know, as an expert on something. And nobody on that channel has had to apologize for anything. So, yes, there's a double standard. And at some point, you know, as you often say, we have to control the narrative. But we can't control the narrative when we're always working for somebody else. If we don't have our own and put the narrative out for ourselves, then all we can do is get in line and get in step with what they tell us to say and do. And that's the problem. You know, even the most free person who you think is free really ain't free, because they answering to somebody else. About the freest person I know right now is Oprah and Tyler. They're about the freest people I know, because he owns his own studio. He can do whatever he want to do, and well, Dick Gregory, yeah, that's true. I forgot about Dick Gregory. And you know, we will then. Let me add one more in, because Farrakhan is free too. So you know, but at the end, but we just did four people out of millions. Give me a break. Everybody else is tied to some other entity, and so they're free up to a certain point. Then they got to show their papers. So, yes,
it's
a double standard.
Showing their papers up.
Yeah.
Even the president, the most powerful man in the world, had to show his paper. And this happened after he was president, because everybody was calling for, you know, before and during, you know, and things of that nature. But after he was president is when he really showed his papers. And that's unfortunate that we're still tied up into that type of, you know, America, where we're still faced with these type of deals. So I want to shift now to the 30th year after the Syria liberation. Now, I don't know if most of you know about this out in the listening audience, but we watched an amazing, wonderful show yesterday on Rainbow Push on the Word Network, which we watch pretty much every Saturday at 10 Central, I think it is. And I like the show for two reasons. One, you can always get a good word from Reverend Jackson or whoever he has on the agenda. But you're also going to get an historical account for something where it's given kind of in a first-person accountability. So invariably, when we hear history given to us, it's normally given to what I'm going to consider fourth person. Not saying that the person that was a part of the history given in his account, but it's a story that was reported of a person and then is filtered by some editor and then published by someone else. So when you go through these layers, quite naturally, you're not going to get always an accurate account of what happened. People have to make sure that there's no plagiarism involved. They have to make sure that they have to give the story in such a way that is inviting. But what you get on when you hear the Reverend Jesse Jackson talk on his show is a firsthand account, and that's what we got yesterday. You know, the interview that they had with retired Commander Robert Goodman was an amazing account because of the fact that it was given from him. it was given from Jesse. It was given from his kids' perspective when Jonathan was younger, what he experienced, his father going through, kind of the conversation, the laughter, and all of those wonderful things reported. And so it was an interesting thing that happened. I want to read the article here, and it says, the Reverend Jesse Jackson was scheduled Saturday to reunite with a Navy lieutenant and former hostage whom he replied he helped liberate from Syria over 30 years ago. Now, Jackson, or Reverend Jackson, that is, negotiated the release of Navy lieutenant, now retired commander, Robert Goodman, on January 4th, 1984. And if you remember, this is the time Reverend Jackson was running for president. Now, after a month of captivity, it was the first in a series of actions that catapulted Jackson into the global spotlight as a diplomacy specialist. It also helped his position in when he ran for U.S. presidency. Reverend Jackson was the second black American to launch a national campaign. The first was the late U.S. Senator Shirley Chisholm, of course, we all know. So to see the interview yesterday on Rainbow Push Coalition was an amazing feat to me. And I'm liking what I'm seeing. Roland Martin did it last week or a couple of weeks ago when he did the Mandela story, which was an amazing account from some historical figures that was during that time, first person type of events. You know, something that we can now be able to record and be able to video, and we can give a chance to control the narrative. So, Jimmy, what do you think about the events that took place yesterday in the whole celebration of this 30 years after liberation?
Well, I think it's important to remember that, you know, for all that we have to say about Reverend Jackson, he was the only one that went over there and was able to get him free, and that wasn't the only time that he's done something like that. It's also important to note that he was not supported by the government initially, that Reagan told him he didn't know what he was doing. You know, he could make things worse. I think it's important to note, which I learned, I don't know if I remember this or if I forgot it, that Minister Faircon went over there with him. And there was another minister, preacher, that went over there as well for this mission. So I think it's important that we remember these things. And I do applaud Roland for his effort in having Reverend Jackson on the other day as well to talk about it. But as you state, you know, we can have these kinds of stories told when we control, you know, the narrative. And so who among us really take into account all that over the years that Reverend Jackson has done, and not only the liberation of people here in America, but across the world, and what it means and what his legacy would mean. And the fact, I agree with you, to hear his son talk about that moment and to hear the commanders talk about the moment, and he looked up and he saw Jonathan and Jesse Jr. over in the corner laughing and giggling during this press conference. He said he knew everything was going to be okay, you know. And so knowing that these people that looked like him came to get him, and he knew at that moment that all was going to be well. And he came back and served in the capacity that he's always done in the Navy. And so I just think the story itself should be told, and we should never forget it. And I think we are guilty sometimes as a group, as a race, of forgetting our past and not talking about it because we want to say, oh, that happened so long ago. But everything in history happened so long ago. There's a reason why we still celebrate President's Day. I guess because we think the presidents are important. There's a reason why there's a D-Day and we celebrate Veterans Day and we celebrate all of these marks in history that happened so long ago. We still celebrate them. So why not celebrate who we are and the things that we've overcome and the things that we've been able to do as a race against tremendous odds? So having Reverend Jackson still around to tell the story, I think is phenomenal. The fact that he's still here in a sound mind and can still get the story out and is still feared, you know, as free as he is, he's still feared by many. He's still feared by the establishment because they know what power he can have. And so they've tried over the years to diminish his power, but he's still here. And so when you look at you know, the Jesse Jacksons of the world and the Minister Farrakhan's and the Al Sharptons of the world. Those men are feared, and they do everything they can to keep them separated and try to keep them isolated from one another, because they know together that's a force that can't be reckoned with. And so we've got to be smarter about our history, and we've got to know it. We've got to know more about not just Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth and Mary McLeod Bethune. We've got to know more about Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, and we got to know more than, there had to be more than one Frederick Douglass, you know. He couldn't have been the only one. You know, the 12 Years of Slave, you know, Solomon Northup, that's a story. That's true. That really happened. You know, and I'm sure he wasn't the only one. So let's, you know, we need to do a better job of telling our story and listening to our story and being able to learn from them. And learning from Reverend Jackson, if you ever sit and listen and listen to what he has to say, he has a purpose for everything. Everything he does, there's a purpose behind it. We might not always understand it. We definitely might not always agree with it. But at the end of the day, he is still here, and he's still here for a reason. So you have to respect that.
Yeah, not to mention when you look at the consistency of a Reverend Jackson and the consistency of an Al Sharpton, and when they've always been on your side. I mean, you know, win, lose, or draw, they're going to be right there. And to see that if we don't have them too, who's going to be fighting for us? You know, who's going to go out there and get stabbed? Who's going to go out there and get ridiculed on a day-to-day basis? Who's going to go out there and go to the president and get said to the president, you don't know what you're doing? I mean, it's coming from the president of the United States. How demoralizing that could be when President Ronald Reagan told Reverend Jesse Jackson, you don't know what you're doing. You could risk your situation. I mean, you know, and so for them to consistently be in the fight, to consistently advocate for equal rights, I mean, I think it's an amazing feat in themselves, and I applaud them, and we need to celebrate them. We really need to say, we need to lift them up, you know, not just only in prayer, but through financial donations, by participation, by volunteerism. We need to lift them up, and other organizations that are out there fighting civil rights and things of that nature.
For sure. I totally agree with that.
All right, we're up against the top of the hour here. We're going to take another break, and when we return, we're going to be talking about the Affordable Care Act. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, Tailor-Made Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Gemma, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for a discounted book for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, Tailor-Made Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TailorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Gemma. And Ask Gemma says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my
stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Patrick Cook.
Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. Bitter cold is gripping northern and midwestern states. Duluth, Minnesota, registering minus 21. Bismarck, North Dakota, 9 below zero. Wind chill warnings are in effect from Montana eastward to the central Appalachians. In Green Bay, Wisconsin, a sold-out crowd is sitting in 5-degree temperatures for the NFC wildcard playoff game between the Packers and the San Francisco 49ers. This same weather system is expected to carry record lows to the south and east tomorrow. Congress returns to work this week. The Senate goes back to work tomorrow. And as NPR's Nathan Rott reports, Senate Democrats and President Obama are pushing to make the extension of unemployment benefits one of the first priorities.
Federal unemployment benefits for roughly 1.3 million people ended a few days after Christmas. President Obama said that extending those benefits for America's long-term unemployed should be Congress's first order of business when they return to Washington. Democratic Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island has crafted a bill with Republican help that would temporarily reinstate those benefits. He spoke about it during a teleconference Sunday.
We hope on a bipartisan basis we can go ahead and at least establish for the next 3 months these benefits, and it'll give the responsible committees the time to look more carefully at this, and we hope that there's a full-year extension.
Some Republicans argue that those benefits are not needed and that they just perpetuate joblessness. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
Secretary of State John Kerry is consulting with leaders in Jordan and Saudi Arabia today as he continues diplomatic efforts to get Israel and the Palestinians closer to a framework for a peace deal. Kerry says both sides have a sharper idea of the compromises needed to secure an agreement. He also addressed another Middle East flashpoint, Syria. As NPR's Peter Kenyon reports, Kerry opened the door for Iran to participate in Syrian peace talks.
Speaking in Jerusalem, Kerry suggested that Iran could participate in the so-called Geneva II talks from the sidelines or through their diplomatic mission in Geneva if the UN decides that would be helpful in addressing the conflict in Syria. The comments appear to soften Washington's long-held position that Iran must accept all aspects of the final statement from the first Geneva talks on Syria, including the formation of a transitional authority. Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif discussed Syria with Turkish officials this weekend. The Syrian National Council, a main opposition bloc, is also meeting in Istanbul, and its leaders say it sees no benefit from attending the Geneva II talks. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
The U.S. Embassy in Beirut is warning Americans in Lebanon to avoid hotels, Western-style shopping centers and grocery stores, any social events where U.S. citizens normally gather. The security warning follows a series of deadly bombings and other violence in the Lebanese capital linked to the civil war in neighboring Syria. This is NPR. A U.S. Coast Guard icebreaker is on its way to help several ships and their crew members stuck in the Antarctic. Stuart Cohen reports from Sydney.
The American icebreaker, the Polar Star, is cutting short a planned stopover in Sydney to rush to the aid of the stranded ships. The saga began on Christmas Eve when a Russian research vessel became stuck in ice during a storm. Three separate icebreakers from France, China, and Australia were unable to reach the ship before the Chinese sent a helicopter to ferry 52 passengers to freedom. But then the Chinese icebreaker found itself trapped. The Polar Star was en route to clear a shipping channel to the American Research Station in Antarctica when the Australian, Russian, and Chinese governments asked for help. Australia, China, and France have all had to limit or cancel Antarctic summer research missions as a result of the rescue efforts, and Australia says it wants to charge the Russian vessel for the costs. For NPR News, I'm Stuart Cohen in Sydney.
Former presidential candidate Mitt Romney says he believes athletes at the Olympic Games in Sochi next month will be safe. The comments come after two suicide bombings last week in the Russian city of Volgograd. Romney, who led the 2002 Winter Games in Salt Lake City, told Fox News Sunday Russia has done everything possible to prevent violence at the Games. Reforms threatens to undermine the Olympic spirit. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from...
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Well, we're up against the top of the hour, and I'm so excited to have Mr. Gunn, Mr. Healthcare, join us today. Now, for those of you that don't know, Anton Gunn is a nationally acclaimed leader, expert, consultant, and speaker on healthcare reform, known in many circles as Mr. Healthcare. Anton Gunn is one of America's leading voices for common sense, consumer-focused, market-driven health reform that results in accessible, affordable, quality healthcare in America. He is one of the nation's most respected political leaders on the subject. Gunn is widely recognized for the groundbreaking role he played in the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, now also known as Obamacare. So in just a few minutes, we're going to bring Mr. Gunn on here. So I'm very excited to have him on. But let me say this. First and foremost, it is certainly an honor to have such a person join the show. Of course, if you don't know, Mr. Gunn has been on MSNBC. He's been around around the nation, helping get healthcare off the ground. So I'm very excited to have Mr. Gunn join. Mr. Gunn, are you there?
I am here.
Welcome to the show.
Happy to be with you today, Patrick.
Well, it's definitely a pleasure. I want to first start by asking you to kind of talk a little bit about how you really got started in this particular line of work. And obviously, you're so passionate about it. Can you talk a little bit about how you got started with this?
I'm very happy to do so. It's just been a blessed life experience to be able to work on something that I care so much about. So very quickly, you know, I'm originally from Virginia Beach, Virginia, and if anybody knows anything about Virginia Beach, you know it's a hotbed for military services and military support. And so my father was a Navy veteran for 22 years, and so I was a Navy brat. And everybody knows that if you have a parent that's in the military, you never have to worry about health insurance because it's taken care of and paid for fully by the United States government, and you just use the health care as needed. So my entire life I grew up with health insurance, never questioning whether I'd be able to pay for prescription drugs or deal with anything. And then secondarily, as I turned 18 and was able to become an adult and leave out of my parents' house, I went to the University of South Carolina to play football. Yes, I played big-time Division I college football, and when I was playing for the Gamecocks, I got lots of injuries. Broke a toe, chipped bones in my spine, I had spasms and broken wrists, all kinds of stuff. I had challenges. But guess what? I never worried about paying for health care then either because playing football, my big-time university with this millions of dollars provided me excellent health care. So I never had to question whether I was going to be able to get treatment for a cold or treatment for any of the multiple injuries that I had obtained over the time that I was in college. But it wasn't until I was, 22 years old. I had finished college, and I had gotten my first job out of college trying to make sure I stay healthy because I was an athlete my entire life. I said, well, I got a physical every year from the time I was in middle school through college to play football. I want to go to the doctor and get a physical, and I got health insurance, so that should be able to be something that they can do for me. And I went to my doctor, and he told me, I'd be happy to give you a full physical, but I hope you know that your insurance doesn't cover this preventive, routine physical. And I was like, well, that's crazy. I'm trying to stay healthy. Why they don't cover my health coverage? And that is when I got introduced to the world of private health insurance that the vast majority of Americans have, or even through your employer-based coverage. And I was blessed to work at a small nonprofit. And my first job at that nonprofit was as an organizer, a community organizer, and my title was healthcare reform coordinator, because this was in the mid to late 1990s, right after the Clintons tried to reform healthcare under that presidency and ran into a lot of trouble. And we saw states trying to do different things to try to make changes to the healthcare system for people individually and incrementally. And so my job was to educate consumers about the changes in the marketplace and make sure that they could be advocates for changes that actually improved quality, lowered costs, and provided more access to millions of people who, at that point in time, were uninsured and couldn't get treatment for things that they need.
Wow, that is a fascinating story. I have a similar story. When I was in the military, I served in the military for over a decade. Was a Desert Shield, Desert Storm veteran, and when I got out, quite naturally, like you, I had all of this, you know, free health care. When I got out, I started working for corporate and still had the same thing. And so I eventually got married, and my wife told me that, you know, you have to look at these pre-existing conditions when you try to add someone to your insurance. So I was kind of baffled by the fact that, seriously, they're going to be looking at pre-existing conditions? And even pregnancy was considered at the time a pre-existing condition. So how significant is it for the Affordable Care Act to really include pre-existing conditions in the coverage?
So this is a really important point, and this is one I think so many people glazed over. The Affordable Care Act, when it was passed in March of 2010, the law really was to play out over a 10-year period. So you really have to look at the Affordable Care Act as if it's a 10-year piece of legislation. Some changes went into effect in 2010. That is, raising the level at which you can keep your young adult child on your health insurance plan. You can keep them up to age 26. The young children can't be discriminated against because they have pre-existing conditions. So there was changes in 2010, other changes in 2011, but the big changes happened this year, 2014, January 1st, and that is, up to, you know, no matter who you are, no matter where you live, is no discrimination because you have a pre-existing condition. No insurance plan can say, hey, I'm not going to cover these services because, you know, you had it before you enrolled in my plan. Or they can't say, oh, because you had breast cancer 5 years ago, we're going to charge you a higher premium because you're probably going to get breast cancer again, and we don't want to pay for that, so we're going to make you pay right now to make up for the money that we're going to lose later because you got sicker. And this is an important issue for millions of Americans, because here's three numbers, two numbers I'm going to just throw out. Number one, 129 million. That number is important because there's research that shows that nearly 129 million Americans have some form of pre-existing condition. It could be sleep apnea. It could be asthma. It could be high blood pressure. It could be diabetes. It could be skin cancer. It could be a whole bunch of things. And before the Affordable Care Act went into effect this year, you could be denied coverage for services related to that pre-existing condition. So 129 million Americans. The second number I want to raise is 17 million. That is the number of children in this country that could have a pre-existing condition, that could have been denied access for coverage for those services, but they can't be discriminated against because of the Affordable Care Act. So millions of people now don't have to worry about that. They don't have to worry about being denied because the law says that all plans, all insurance plans, must cover those services even if you had a pre-existing condition.
Wow. That's good. I think that definitely clarifies the importance of the pre-existing condition. So I hear this term. You mentioned you cannot no longer be covered, denied coverage because of cancer that they had 5 years ago or some existing condition they had 5 years ago. Well, I lived in an area in Anniston, Alabama, for a large majority of my life, and it's kind of plagued with cancer. It's primarily associated with what happened with Monsanto, and there was a big suit that came out of that, and that's well documented. And so a lot of people in that area has come up with some ailment down there. There's a term that talks about lifetime limits. Can you talk a little bit about what that means and how that is a part of the ACA, Affordable Care Act, and what that means to consumers to not have any lifetime limits?
Well, that's a great point to raise, is that to really try to drive this home, I'll give you a framework for it. Let's say, you know, you have health insurance coverage. You've been paying for it every year of your life, or your employer has been providing it for you every year of your life, and you do come down with some bad health challenge. It could be cancer, or it could be a tumor, some major benign or malignant tumor that you need to get major treatment for. And over your life, you spend your insurance plan spends money on providing you care and providing you treatment. And let's say you're in the middle of chemotherapy, and millions of Americans, this has happened to them before, that in the middle of their treatment for their previous condition, they would get a letter in the mail from their insurance company that says that you reached the maximum cap on your policy of $1 million, which means you've had more than $1 million worth of treatment. And because of that, we're no longer covering treatment related to that illness. And so, you know, there are patients who have been in the middle of cancer treatment, and they've gotten this letter, and it basically told them that if you want to continue with your cancer treatments, you're going to have to find a way to pay for this out of your pocket because you reached the cap on your insurance policy. And so that cap could have been $1 million. It could have been $2 million, depending on the plan that you were in. But thanks to the Affordable Care Act, this no longer happens. There are no caps on insurance policies now. So they can't say that once you reach $1 million in services that we're no longer going to cover you. And this is really important because this is a big deal for keeping people out of bankruptcy. We know that there's research out there that shows that, 48% of people that filed bankruptcy had a major medical health condition in the previous 18 months, something that, you know, cost them a lot of money, and if their plan didn't provide coverage for it and wouldn't pay for it, they had to pay for it out of their pocket, and it ended up driving people into bankruptcy. And so the Affordable Care Act, making sure that no insurance plan can have a cap on how much care or coverage that you would have on your insurance policy, is a big deal for so many people to allow them to get the treatment that ultimately gets them healthy rather than driving them into bankruptcy.
Wow, that's very good. I appreciate that. One of the things that I see often, and this is kind of around the language of this new law and a lot around the language of just insurance in general. I mean, even though I've been covered, I still have to go through, you know, trying to figure out what's being said in these plans every year. So I want to talk a little bit about the plans, but before we do that, there's a provision called Medicare expansion that's a part of the Affordable Care Act. Can you talk a little bit about that and explain what that means in the context of what it was before and then what it is now?
So that's a great point. So I want to make sure I clarify so many things about this. So this will try to be as educational for people as possible.
Okay.
So the Affordable Care Act is a very comprehensive law. It really deals with several different pieces of our healthcare system. You and I were just talking a second ago about you being in the military and then me being a military brat and you being a veteran and then both working in the private sector and having individual policies. To really give people a framework of health insurance in America, we love to talk about in this country that we have the greatest healthcare system in America. We don't have one healthcare system. We literally have what I like to frame up as six different healthcare systems. So the first system is one that we talked about, that if you're in active duty military, you get your health care provided to you in a certain way that is completely different from everybody else in the country. And that's how it gets taken care of. Then if you're a veteran, if you're not active duty military, you have a completely different system of health care than those who are active duty. And it is something that the rest of us can't have access to if we were not a veteran or not active duty. So that's two different systems right there. Then the third system is one that we provide in this country for our seniors. It's an entitlement that we've said to every senior in America that once you turn age 65, that you're provided health insurance coverage through the Medicare program. So Medicare is the third system. Then there's a fourth system. This is a system that's provided for low-income people. It's called Medicaid. And Medicaid is completely different than veterans health insurance, then active duty military insurance, and then the Medicare program, because Medicaid is for low-income folks, and it operates differently depending on the state that you live in. So if you live in Alabama, and you could be low-income enough to be on Medicaid, but if you move to South Carolina, your income might be too much money, and you don't qualify for Medicaid. So it's a state-based program that is funded by the federal government in partnership with the states, but it's completely different than those others. So you got four systems right there. But the fifth system is one that the vast majority of people in this country are in, and that is the employer-based private health care system. And that is, you have a job where you're provided health insurance coverage, and there are different rules around how you get that coverage, how you keep that coverage, when you renew that coverage. The private employer-based system is different from Medicaid, Medicare, Veterans Insurance, and active duty insurance. So that's five different. But the last one, and this is the one that the Affordable Care Act really tries to address most, and that is the health care system for the people that we call the uninsured. The uninsured are people who don't get health care any other way other than maybe through the emergency room. Maybe they go to a community health center or a free medical clinic, but really most times they only get any kind of health information is when their church or their social service agency decides to have a free blood pressure screening for everybody after Sunday service, or we're going to do a diabetes test or HIV test after this community event. So this is so fragmented and broken for people who are uninsured. And so what the Affordable Care Act tried to do is to help those folks who are uninsured by expanding the Medicaid program, which is Medicaid is, again, state-based, and we said to states in the law that states, you can expand your Medicaid program to provide coverage for people who are considered to be low income but maybe make a little bit more money than what you have in your existing Medicaid program. So to give you the dollar amount of what I'm talking about, if you are a single person that makes less than $15,000 a year, the ACA was set out in a framework to say that if you fit that category of making less than $15,000 a year, you should be able to get your health insurance coverage provided to you free by the Medicaid program, which is you won't have a monthly premium. You may have some small copay of $2 or $3, but you'd be able to go to primary care doctors, get treatment for your illnesses, and have coverage. This is a way to raise the floor for low-income folks. Now, I know you're probably thinking, man, $15,000 a year, that's Poe. And you know what Poe is, that you can't even afford the last two letters. You just
right,
don't.
Right. Right?
So, but you're probably wondering, you know, that's so low income. Those people can't afford private health insurance anyway. Well, guess what? Before the Affordable Care Act, that was the case. They couldn't afford anything, and that's why they were the uninsured. And so the law wants to expand Medicaid. But here's the hiccup. When the Supreme Court made its decision in June of 2012, made the decision to say that Medicaid, you cannot force states to expand Medicaid. That's an optional program for states, and so the law can't force states to expand Medicaid. So some states who were opposed to the policy of the Affordable Care Act made a decision to deny poor people access to health insurance coverage in their states by not expanding the Medicaid program. So some 25 states said no. Alabama said no. South Carolina said no. North Carolina said no. Tennessee said no. Florida said no. And multiple other states have all made a decision to say no to expanding health coverage for low-income people. Now, here's one thing I want to say about Medicare, which is a program for our senior citizens. There is nothing that any governor or any administrator can do to take away Medicare from our seniors. That is an entitlement program for all Americans. It is not going away. There's no seniors that are going to lose Medicare services or benefits because of the Affordable Care Act. It's just the opposite. Medicare is getting better because of the Affordable Care Act by doing things like making sure that our seniors can get routine screenings for cancer and depression and cholesterol and diabetes, that they can get these screenings for free, where before the Affordable Care Act, they had to pay for them. The second thing that the Affordable Care Act is doing for Medicare recipients is lowering the cost of their prescription drugs. Seniors have saved an average of $800 a year because of the Affordable Care Act closing this thing called the donut hole, which is a gap in prescription drug coverage for our seniors. So that's the two things that the Affordable Care Act does, is try to expand Medicaid for poor people so they can get coverage and get treatment and get the care that they need, and to make Medicare stronger for our seniors so they can have lower cost prescription drugs and they can get these screenings that they need that are designed to help catch things in early stages so we don't have to expensively treat them later on, that they can live longer, healthier lives because they got routine screenings that they needed and deserved.
Wow. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, and we're joined with Mr. Gunn a.k.a. Mr. Healthcare. Now, Mr. Gunn is a nationally acclaimed leader, expert, consultant, and speaker on healthcare reform. He is the founder and president of the 937 Strategy Group, a consulting firm based in Washington, D.C. And Mr. Gunn, a lot of times when people hear this term government-provided health care, when they hear the term Affordable Care Act, there are so many different there's so much coverage around this in a negative way that some people think that perhaps the government is providing health care. Can you talk a little bit about, even though that you sign up for this health care, who's providing the service? Is it the government that's providing the service?
No, absolutely not. Under the Affordable Care Act, there is no new expansion of a government program to provide health insurance. What the health insurance marketplace is, and so for anybody that goes to healthcare.gov, what you are going to is you're going to a web portal that will help you to sort and shop for private health insurance coverage that meets your needs and fits into your budget. So what do I mean, private health insurance coverage? It's just what you know. It's companies like Aetna, Blue Cross and Blue Shield, Coventry Healthcare, Humana Healthcare, the same private companies who provide health policies for people who work in large corporations or that work in other industries. So this search engine, if you will, healthcare.gov, is a way for you to go in to sort these plans by price or by what benefits they cover. And then also this search engine will help you to learn if you qualify for financial aid to help you to buy insurance. That's a big deal for a lot of people, because many reasons why people didn't have health insurance coverage before is, one, because they were discriminated against because they had pre-existing conditions, and number two, because they just couldn't afford it. So the Affordable Care Act actually provides tax subsidies to help you to pay for insurance. And tax subsidies is a funny big word. Most people know what it means, but I like to break it down by saying it's financial aid. So the same way if you have a child that you're applying to try to get them in college and you fill out a bunch of forms online to see if they qualify for financial aid, you can go to healthcare.gov and fill out and see if you qualify for financial aid to help you to pay your health insurance premium every month. So this is not government health care. This is private health insurance. These are individual private plans that have to follow some new rules, which is they have to cover all of the things that you need to have covered. It covers prescription drugs. It covers maternity. It covers mental health services. It covers, hospitalization and outpatient services. So the government has said no private insurance plan can be crappy anymore. They can't sell you a plan that doesn't meet your needs of what most people use when they buy health insurance. And the second thing that it says is that these private plans are going to be affordable, and how we decide that is based upon your income and your household size. You can qualify for financial assistance to help you to pay for this private health insurance plan every single month.
So let's talk a little bit more. I want to unpack this notion of financial support or tax subsidies or financial aid that you mentioned. In particular, I want to talk a little bit about when you're provided with health care and you qualify, I'm awarded the financial aid. How does that transaction take place? Do I get the money in a check? Do I get it in the mail? Or how does that happen?
That's a great question. So nobody's getting checks in the mail through the marketplace. So here's how it works. You go to healthcare.gov, you create an account, and then you fill out an application. And if you're deemed eligible for a tax credit, if you're eligible for financial aid, if you will, that eligibility will be determined by your household size and your modified adjusted gross income. So you got to know your W-2 tax information, because the IRS is the one who's going to provide you the tax credit, because that's who provides all tax credits in this country on the federal level is the IRS. So once you're determined eligible for a tax credit, you'll be told what that amount is. So I'm going to give you just kind of an example. So I helped a gentleman just a couple weeks ago go through the healthcare.gov website and found out that he was eligible for a $376 tax credit every single month. That added up to be about $4,500 for the whole year. But every month he would get a tax credit for $376. So what he then had to do was go find a private health insurance plan that actually made sense for him. So he went and searched the website and found a plan that met his needs, and his doctor was in the network, and so he was happy with the plan. So the plan was about $600. And so when you apply his $376 tax credit, the difference for him is $225 a month, if you will. Okay? So $225, he has to make a payment every single month. When he makes that payment, the IRS will send that $376 directly to the health insurance plan that he picked. So you won't even see this tax credit come into your pocket or out of your pocket. It's sent on your behalf directly to the insurance company to provide you that subsidy, and you're responsible for paying the difference of that plan every single month. Now, I'll also tell you that there are some people who have such a large subsidy that they don't have much of premium at all. I talked about a woman who I heard on the news the other day got a health insurance plan in the state of Pennsylvania, and every single month her premium is $1.71 because her tax credit was so large that it covered the entire premium, basically. So that's how it works.
Wow, that's amazing. So I think I understand now what it means to qualify. But what about me or my cousin or my uncle who may not qualify, and they don't work for a corporate institution that gets private insurance? Can I also go out to the Affordable Care Act, or I mean to the healthcare.gov, and get insurance and be provided a plan as well?
Yes. So anybody, again, this is the real framework of what the law is focused on. If you are self-employed, or if you're a single person, you don't get coverage provided to you by your job. So maybe you're an entrepreneur, maybe you're a real estate agent, maybe you're just an independent contractor and you do painting, or maybe you're a trucker and you work independently and you don't have health coverage. Everybody can go to healthcare.gov to see if you qualify for a subsidy. And if you don't qualify for a subsidy, you can use healthcare.gov to buy a health insurance policy that meets your needs, okay? And so what does that really mean? Is that healthcare.gov is a portal that basically forces insurance companies to compete against each other for customers. Because, again, when you go to this website, you're not just going to see one plan from Blue Cross and Blue Shield. You may see four plans, and it could represent Blue Cross and Blue Shield, Aetna, and Humana. So you could have three companies competing against each other for your dollar. And so what happens when you have competition in the marketplace? Prices come down, the quality of the product, and the services go up. So the Affordable Care Act actually creates an opportunity for consumers to be able to shop for competitive rates, competitive plans that actually meets their needs. And so I encourage everybody to go to healthcare.gov to see what you may qualify for, and you'll be surprised because the threshold is very high. I've had lots of people tell me, oh, man, I don't qualify for nothing. I never qualify for food stamps. I can't get no welfare. I can't get housing subsidies. I can't get nothing. So I'm not even going to go to healthcare.gov because I never qualify. That would be the biggest mistake that you can make, is not to go to healthcare.gov because you think that you may not qualify. Because, again, family of four can make up to $94,000 a year and could qualify for a subsidy to help them to pay for health insurance. If you're a single person, you can make up to $46,000 a year and qualify for a subsidy. So as you can see, that this is a very generous subsidy where 90% of the eligible uninsured could qualify for a subsidy. So you never know unless you go through the process. And that's why it's important for people to go to healthcare.gov and go through the process.
That's amazing. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Press 1 to talk and 2 to listen. So I know you only got a few more minutes, but I want to clarify a few things for me. I want to know if I go out there, can I keep my doctor? So I want to go out there in the marketplace. Can I keep my doctor if I join healthcare.gov, if I go out there in healthcare.gov?
Of course you can. So here's the deal. This is where folks have to start to use a little common sense and do something that we're not really familiar with doing in health insurance. And when I say that, I say in all earnest that the typical American consumer has very little understanding about health insurance and how health insurance works. They also have very little understanding about how much it actually costs, because you have people who, you know, go to work every day and they got a job at a large employer, and they look at their pay stub and they see that every month about $125 gets taken out of their check to pay for health insurance. And they're thinking in their mind that my health insurance at work only costs $125, when that's actually not the case, because your employer generally subsidizes some 50 to 75, sometimes 80% of your health insurance costs. So if you're paying $125 for health insurance, your employer could be contributing another $975. And you just wouldn't know it by looking at your paycheck. So the whole point would be is that you got to get yourself educated about how health insurance works. And one of the things you should do more than anything else is to make sure that your doctor is in the network of the plan that you want. And how do you do that? You can do that sometimes online by going to your insurance company's website and searching their provider network. But the safest thing you can do is if you went to healthcare.gov and you found a plan that you like, let's say it's a Blue Cross and Blue Shield silver plan that actually looks pretty good in terms of premium and deductible, well, the first thing you want to do is pick up the phone and call your doctor and say, hey, doc, I'm looking to enroll in this health insurance plan from Blue Cross and Blue Shield. It's a silver plan, 80-20. Do you accept that insurance? And when that doctor says yes, then pick that plan. If the doctor says no, then search for another plan where your doctor is in the network. That's the simplest thing to do, is to really validate that by talking to your physician and whether they're in that network or not. Because, again, everybody loves their physician. They don't want to lose them. You definitely can keep your physician, but you have to make a decision to pick a plan that your provider is in that network.
So when you mention the term plans, what is this metallic plan? What's the notion around metallic plans?
So, yeah, so this is one of the things that I think it was put into the law and explained unnecessarily confusing for people. So when you go to healthcare.gov, there are four metal levels of plans that you'll see. And just you can kind of think about it like, you know, records, or you can think about it like the Olympics. You got bronze plans, you got silver plans, you got gold plans, and you got platinum plans. So there are four different metal levels: bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. Now, what that really means, and this is how I really try to break it down to people, the lower the metal level, so the bronze plan, the lower the metal level means that it's an actuarial value, and I won't even get into actuarial value because it's hard to explain to people, but I'll just say it to you like this. The lower the metal level, the lower your monthly premium is likely to be. So you can pick a bronze plan, and you may not have to pay much out of your pocket every single month for a premium, but when you use the health insurance, it'll cover less, and so you'll have more out-of-pocket costs when you use your health services. So, again, an example would be you pick a bronze plan, and your premium might be $100 a month, but when you go to the doctor for an office visit, you may have an office visit cost of $50 a month, or you may have to pay $25 for prescription drugs, or your deductible may be higher. Your deductible could be $12,000, or, you know, when you go use services, you may have to pay 40% when your insurance plan only pays 60%. That's the bronze. But the higher you go up on the metal level, let's say you pick a platinum plan, your premium may be a lot higher every single month, but when you go to the doctor, you won't have any out-of-pocket costs. So, for instance, I gave you the example of a bronze plan being $100 a month. Let's say you pick the platinum plan, it might be $700 a month. So you can see there's a big difference between a bronze and a platinum in this example. But paying that $700 a month means that anytime you go to the doctor, you don't pay anything out of pocket. So no copays for office visits, no copays for prescription drug. Your deductible might be $500 versus, again, $12,000 in the bronze plan. If you go to the doctor and you have brain surgery or heart surgery, your insurance plan may cover 100% of the cost, and you won't have to pay any copay or coinsurance, or you won't have to pay part of that bill because you bought a platinum plan that covers lots of benefits and provides lots of services at no cost to you, and the only cost to you is what you pay in that premium every single month. Now, both of these are just kind of hypothetical examples of what you'll see, but the bronze plans provide a lower premium for people. So, again, if you want the safety of security of knowing you have health insurance coverage and you're protected to get the treatment that you need, the screenings that you need, then pick a bronze plan if you think that makes sense for you and your family. But if you're a high user of healthcare, which is you may have a chronic condition and you go to the doctor every week for asthma shots, or you go to the doctor for allergy shots every week and your prescription drugs are very expensive, the higher the metal level, the more likelihood that all of those things will be covered by your plan and you won't have as much out-of-pocket costs.
Which means that I won't, by me picking a bronze plan, I won't have a different type of card. I won't have a funny-looking logo on my card that says I got a bronze plan. It just really
absolutely
means
not.
The service that I'm getting won't be different. I won't be getting a Fiat service versus Cadillac service. It's just the amount of dollars that I would be paying up front versus over a longer period of time.
That's correct. That's exactly right. So there's no different color cards for who has a bronze, silver, or gold plan. There's no distinguishing features to any of these cards. Again, it's just about what you pay and how much your insurance plan covers for you, what you have to pay out of pocket, and what's covered over the long term.
Awesome. I'm going to bring my co-host Jima on the line. She has a few questions for you, Mr. Gunn. Jima?
Hi. One of my questions is around the what do you say to the naysayers out there that continually want to tear down this law or say that people are scamming the government, or that, you know, the people that the navigators are out there setting people up that really don't qualify? What do you say to those people?
Well, I'm going to be real honest, and I'm going to be as brutally honest as I possibly can. I've stopped listening to naysayers about 2 years ago because they have demonstrated that they don't have the compassion and the capacity to care about making sure that the 41 million Americans who don't have any access to health insurance coverage get the opportunity to get coverage. It'd be different if you had a different idea about how to provide coverage to people who are uninsured, or if you were really interested in helping people to get coverage. But the naysayers that continue to, you know, complain about the law or vote to repeal the law or complain that all of this bad stuff is happening, they don't even understand the law, number one, but they just chosen to make a decision to figure out how they can not help America to be great. And I really believe that that's what they're doing, because anybody will tell you that the fact that we have high numbers of uninsured and people who don't get coverage, and we have higher mortality rates and people die sicker, quicker, they die younger in this country than some 39 other industrialized countries, they don't understand that not having a healthy populace impacts our competitiveness as a country on the world stage. And so for me, if you want a stronger, healthier America, which means you want a stronger country, a better country, a more successful country, a more economically viable country, one of the first things we all can do is to make sure that everybody in our family can get treatment for the health challenges that they have, that they can get better from those challenges. Think about how many, scientists that could cure cancer are not curing cancer because they never got treatment for their depression when they were in college.
Mm.
Think about what we won't get when we have people who are not healthy. So those detractors have shown me over and over and over again that they're not interested in trying to help people. They're interested in just finding something to complain about, because there's always something to complain about, that, hey, you know, my doctor's not in the network of this plan, or, you know, this plan cost me $100 more than it did last year. Yes, those things on a small scale are challenges, but we can overcome those challenges if everybody was interested in helping to solve the challenge rather than just being a naysayer and complaining about how things are happening. We got to work together to make it better, and that's what we should be doing rather than focusing on the detractors. And so I just kind of let them be who they are, because they show themselves very quickly.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
Okay.
And the other one,
go
Well, you kind of mentioned it when you talked about those that talk about their premiums going up and all that kind of thing. You kind of touched on that one, too, so that was good, too. Thanks.
Okay, so, Mr. Gunn, I want to know a little bit more about the 937 Strategy Group. It's a consultant firm, so talk a little bit about what that is and what services are provided there.
So that's a great question, and I've been dwelling on this for a long time about stepping out and being an entrepreneur and starting my own business. One of the things that 937 Strategies is focused on is helping leaders to make the right decisions as it relates to health care and the Affordable Care Act in their business. And what do I mean by that? Our goal is to work with chief executive officers, senior leadership in small businesses, large businesses, even people who are in the government sector. So, for instance, if you're the governor of a state, you're a chief executive officer of that state, and you are going to have to make decisions about how health care is implemented in your state and what health care reform means for you. So our primary goal is to provide advice and consultation services and even a framework of how you can successfully implement health care in your business, in your organization, or in your state or your government entity. That is the primary core of most of our services, is really trying to demystify, break down the Affordable Care Act in ways that businesses can understand, that organizations can understand, and actually make decisions. The second part of our business is really focused on communicating with your employees, communicating with your customers, communicating with those that you service about the changes in healthcare. We just sat here and had a full conversation around what people are confused about and what people don't understand, what people cannot figure out. And so they continue to ask these questions and not really understand. And one of the things I like to say to people is that the Affordable Care Act is for the uninsured, people who don't have coverage, or maybe you're a small business owner trying to find coverage for yourself or for your employees. That is the focus. But the messaging around the Affordable Care Act is heard by everybody. So you can work at a Fortune 500 company, and you could have health insurance and have had health insurance for the last 40 years, but you're still wondering, is Obamacare going to hurt me, help me, or affect me in any kind of way? What does the Affordable Care Act mean for me? And so somebody needs to do a better job of communicating to customers, to employees, to business owners, and to the public at large, and that is what our goal is to help people to communicate more effectively about how the Affordable Care Act will or will not impact people. And that is a complicated job because healthcare communications is something that's very difficult. Healthcare is very personal to all of us, but we think about it in only those personal terms and haven't been communicated with on a broad scale about how this makes sense to us, why it matters, and how we should respond to it. So those two pieces are the frameworks of our work. We do lots of individual development and coaching with executives on all aspects of healthcare, helping them to think about the future of healthcare, because one of the things that's for certain, that change has come in healthcare in America, and it will continue to happen over the next 5 years. So helping leaders to figure out how do you get in front of the change that's happening to position yourself and your business to not only be successful, but to figure out how the opportunity to help others to be successful. So those are some of the frameworks around 937 Strategy Group. I'm also, as you can tell, someone who talks about this very passionately. I travel the country providing keynote speeches at conferences and other organization entities to talk about the Affordable Care Act. And I do that through myself, 937 Strategy Group, is a part of that. And people can learn more about it by going to AntonGunn.com and figuring out how they can connect with me, because I'd be happy to travel and talk to your organization or your group.
Okay, and that's AntonGunn.com. That's AntonGunn.com, correct?
That's correct.
AntonGunn.com. You know, Mr. Gunn, you know, you really enlightened me and my listeners, and I can't thank you enough. And we only scratched the surface of this issue. And I know as the weeks and months to come, as things roll out and people get more educated, because we're going to continue through this effort to make sure people are informed, things of that nature. We're going to be looking forward to all the wonderful things that you're doing out there. Are there any other last-minute comments you want to make before you leave?
No, I think the thing that I want to say to people is that before January 2014, millions of Americans had already benefited from the Affordable Care Act over the past 3 years. If you're talking about young adults who get to stay on their parents' health insurance, we know there's 3.1 million young adults that had coverage thanks to the Affordable Care Act that otherwise wouldn't have it. I mentioned already about those seniors. Seniors saved an average of $1,200 on prescription drugs because of the Affordable Care Act. You had 71 million people who got a free preventive service, at least some free service, in the last 3 years because of the Affordable Care Act. And so this is a big deal for people. And everybody should remember that the Affordable Care Act, is a long-term transformation to our healthcare system. And it's something that we all should be aware of, not only from a consumer standpoint, but I tell you this, if you're in business for yourself, if you're an entrepreneur, if you're someone who's looking to be an entrepreneur, you should understand the Affordable Care Act because there are tremendous opportunities involved in the Affordable Care Act to not only help people to be healthier, stronger in America, but to financially do well while doing good. And so that's something that I've been trying to share with entrepreneurs. That's a part of our business, is to talk to entrepreneurial leaders and say, here's what you need to know about the Affordable Care Act. And I'm actually working on a publication that will speak about the changes in healthcare and what it could mean for entrepreneurs in our country.
That's awesome. All right, before you go, I got to ask. I know you're in the SEC, and I know, and I'm from Alabama, so we big Roll Tide fans around here, except my wife. She's a Oklahoma fan. And, of course, we had a house divided over the last couple of days. But outside of that, who you have tomorrow night? FSU or
So here's where I sit. I played for the University of South Carolina, SEC school all the way, have been SEC fan all the way. So I have no choice but to pull for Auburn. I think they have shown themselves to be a team of destiny the way they've won some games this year and put themselves in the position to be able to play this game. It's going to be a tough matchup going against Jameis Winston, who's from Alabama, Heisman Trophy winner, and has a tremendous core of wide receivers on his team and great defense. So I'm looking for a very competitive game, but I'm hoping – the War Eagle is the one who rings the day at the end of the night, and so the SEC can close out the BCS with 7 straight wins, and then we can get on to a real playoff system in college football.
Yes, indeed. Thanks again, Mr. Gunn. Look forward to having you on in the future as this thing develops. We would love to invite you back sometime in the near future.
Be happy to come back on. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. All right. All right, it's time for a break. Yeah, you're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for a discounted book for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com. and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And, of course, my
need a new website? haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full-service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Jimmy, what do you think? What an awesome guy. What a magnificent, well-informed individual, Mr. Gunn.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And I hope that our listening audience was able to get some additional information that they had not heard before, that it answered some questions for them that they had not found this courage or the strength or didn't even know who to ask or didn't even know if it was a legitimate question. So I hope they were able to get some answers and that we provided a service for them that they hadn't had before. And I think one thing that we have to remember, because a lot of energy was put on signing up in December so you can be covered in January. And that, you know, that was what it was, but let's not, you know, it's still an open enrollment period. You know, you can still go on to healthcare.gov and research it and find out which plan works best for you. You know, it doesn't, if you didn't sign up on December 26th, you're still okay. I mean, you know, that was just a deadline to get started by January 1st. And they, you know, they had those mile markers set in place for a reason. But what we don't want people to do is say, oh, I missed it in December, so never mind, and then go another year without having health care. And so when it's there and it's available and 9 times out of 10 it's affordable. So I just hope people are not discouraged by whether or not the website crashes. Go find a person in person. Most of your local civic organizations have navigators that are available for that. And I think Mr. Gunn just gave us, you know, a wealth of information, and I hope that the listening audience received it.
Yeah, you know, and I'm reminded that when it came to Juneteenth, I'm reminded that we are sometimes the last people to get the information. And so I want to make sure that we continue to do our due diligence in providing quality, well-research-based information to the public, because there's so much misinformation out there that it confuses people. And in a lot of cases, you know, we have, you know, good credibility between our constituents, people that know us, understand that we are in this for the best interest of ourselves as well as themselves. So, you know, we're not going to just be out there saying here, you know, one way or the other. We're just going to, you know, be providing people with the facts. You know, and it's important for people to go out there and get the information about healthcare, because you want to be covered. I mean, what sense does it make not to be covered so you can start doing preventive care? You know, I know there's a lot of emphasis been placed on, you know, what happens when you get sick, but how about what's happening before you get sick? What about all the things that you can do up front with these exams and these regular checkups, you know, that you can provide before things get out of hand? So it's very important that our country begin to look into this Affordable Care Act and take advantage of a service that has really been missing for a long time. Jimmy, any final thoughts?
Final thoughts. Being the lone Big 12 person on this conversation today, I do have to give a shout out to the University of Oklahoma, Boomer Sooner, for doing what we set out to do at the Sugar Bowl, and that was to take down the mighty Roll Tide of Alabama. And we did it, and we did it well. So, you know, I have to say Boomer Sooner. And having said that, I am torn between who to cheer for tomorrow, because Although I like the SEC, and I don't necessarily know if I like Auburn. So I'm struggling with not to cheer whether I'm cheering for Auburn or if I'm cheering for Florida State. So I'm really kind of in the middle on this one. I just hope it's a good game since it's a championship game. And I agree with Mr. Gunn. Let's get this all this BCS stuff out the way so we can go have a real playoff season. And maybe that, if they, you know, once the playoff season works well, because, you know, they fought that for years, maybe then we can go into whether or not our players should be compensated for their for the games that they play and for being a part of those teams. So we'll see. But other than that, you know, Boomer Sooner, Happy New Year. This time next week, we would have celebrated our anniversary. And so I'm going to give a pre-shout-out happy anniversary to you and to my family that's probably listening out there. Thank you all for all your support through the years. And there's a surprise that we will be discussing probably in the next couple of weeks about yours truly that we will announce live on Current Events with Patrick Cook. So get ready for that as well. And Happy New Year.
Well, that's our show for today. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Now, I'd like to send a very big thank you out to Mr. Anton Gunn for discussing healthcare today. And, of course, a very special thanks to my co-host, no other than the Jima Hill Cook. Now, until next time, remember it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't send another shout out to the Brothers of Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity Incorporated. So in doing so, I'm going to send you away with this Kappa song.
To the left and